You're with The Science Show on RN. Robin Grimes is a man with three jobs. He lectures on nuclear matters at Imperial College London. He has brief stints at the University of New South Wales. And he's a diplomat representing the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office on matters scientific. Here he is with Robin Williams, and they begin with nuclear prospects.
I think a lot of countries at the moment are concentrating on two things. One, making their reactors safe and secure for the future that are already running. And the second thing is understanding what immediate build they're going to engage in. So I think to a certain extent, Generation 4 reactor designs have not progressed quite as quickly as some of us might have hoped.
What are their advantages in Generation 4?
Of course, it's always very difficult to know exactly what the advantages will be to something you haven't built yet. The actual real engineering challenges tend to come up with all sorts of unexpected problems for you. But the idea will be that the wastes arising will be much less, that the temperatures, perhaps some of the reactor designs allow you to access, means you can do some interesting chemistry, as well as generating electricity. And we also hope that the amount of the uranium atoms that we can use up, undergo fission, is a much greater proportion. At the moment, it's only about 2.5-3% of those uranium atoms in the fuel in any one given reactor is used up. We hope to get to about 70% in some of those Gen 4 designs.
Is the infrastructure smaller than the average power station?
Theoretically, yes. We should be able to make them smaller. Smaller is not always better, but smaller can mean cheaper. I think it's the question of cost that's more important than the actual footprint.
Indeed. And what about the sheer cost? Because that's always been, with nuclear, the huge problem.
Absolutely, it has and continues to be. So a very careful balance of the costs needs to be made, which includes, for example, the decommissioning costs for the reactors, how much it's going to actually cost to deal with the waste. There's an awful lot of different statements about the costs of waste, that they are incredibly high, they're incredibly low. Well, what we do know is it's somewhere in between. So very careful balances. And Gen 4 has certain advantages, but the question is, what's the cost going to be to access those advantages? And until you've built the thing, it's very difficult to know exactly. But although I'm not a sort of a born-again nuclear person, what I would say is important to keep these options on the table, because we don't understand the costs of increased climate change. We don't understand the costs associated with when we run out of fossil fuels and so forth. I'm a bigger advocate of keeping the options open.
Well, in fact, this is quite interesting that now we've got a Royal Commission into the future of nuclear power in South Australia. From what you say, the option for Generation 4 is a long way off still.
Yes.
How many years can you guess?
We could argue that some of the liquid sodium fast reactors are Generation 4 and they are being built at the moment. France, India, Russia has had them for some time. So this is a bit of a sliding scale. But before they would be commonplace, you are certainly talking 30 years, I would guess. But look, that's a guesstimate.
That's virtually a generation. How many countries around the world, you mentioned some, are really interested in this new nuclear option?
Post-Fukushima, what's happened is that the world has polarised. Countries like China are going full tilt ahead in all sorts of build of conventional-like reactors, but also reactors which have greater passive safety systems, which are a little bit towards Gen 4. I mean, Gen 4, one of the advantages that we didn't discuss is the idea that in the event of something unexpected, then they fail gently, I suppose, is a way of thinking about it. So there are a lot of those types of ideas which would be built into the types of reactor that are being constructed. China will be building more reactors than anywhere else, for sure. But the UAE, for example, is in the process of building a series of reactors with help from South Korea at this point in time. The UK is perilously close to a new build programme, and there are a number of different designs on the table which are being built elsewhere in the world. Lots of different countries in lots of different places of preparatory.
Ah, yes, but what about New Zealand?
Oh, no. The question as to whether or not you want to build a reactor comes down at the first point, really, to the engineering issue. The question is, do you need the type of electricity that nuclear provides. And New Zealand, a wonderful country though it is, doesn't have the kind of energy requirements that make nuclear a sensible option. It's got nothing to do with whether or not you think this is a good or a bad thing from an emotional point of view. The engineering point is you don't want nuclear in New Zealand, I think. So it's a non-issue.
They gave you a hard time when you talked about it on the radio, didn't they?
I wouldn't say they gave me a hard time. There was a good, solid discussion. And there was this wonderful tweet, actually, at one point, where somebody described what I was talking about as softly spoken evil, which I think was fantastic. It sounded like some sort of, you know, 1970s British rock band.
Indeed.
I love that. And they made me up a T-shirt with this on as a present afterwards.
Which wonderful.
Oh, isn't that great? It's my favourite T-shirt.
I wonder whether you can wear it in diplomatic receptions, because what I want to ask you is about your situation when you're not at Imperial College running the lab. What, in fact, is a diplomat scientist? What do you do?
Well, sometimes I wake up in the morning and pinch myself and think, how on earth have I ever been allowed to access this sort of world? It's just fantastically interesting. It really is. I mean, the idea is, as the world becomes so much more technologically driven, the issues that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is addressing are all the more technical. So my job is to ensure that UK foreign policy has access to and is informed by the best possible science. And as a concept, many countries are now interested in using science and scientists for diplomatic diplomacy.
How?
Well, there's sort of three aspects of science diplomacy. There's the obvious one. We want to use scientists to help inform the diplomatic processes that are going on. I mean, this would be all the way from non-proliferation issues, uses of nuclear energy through the International Atomic Energy Agencies. You've then got diplomacy for science. Well, you need agreements between countries which facilitate the movement of scientists around the place, and also international agreements to set up new scientific endeavours which are cross-boundary and all that sort of stuff. You know, you've got to get those agreements sorted out. And then the third thing is science in diplomacy. You know, scientists are an international bunch of people. They wander around, and borders are just something that get in the way for scientists doing what they want to do. And so science in diplomacy is the fact that we've got agreements. We're talking to people from all sorts of countries where perhaps formal diplomacy is a bit of a challenge. So therefore, we can use the science and the scientific agreements that are in place to demonstrate that, hey, actually we can talk to each other, and actually, you know what, there's a lot more in common than perhaps we thought.
And when you go to various other countries, you know, we're having a bit of a struggle with science in Australia at the moment. I understand from just having been to the United States, they're doing quite well because Obama supports it. John Holdren, his chief advisor, is fantastic in his support. What about other countries? Is science languishing in some places where it shouldn't be?
I think science and the position of science and the understanding of science by governments goes up and down, just like any other aspect of society. And you know that if things are a bit low at one point, they're going to be higher at a different point. It's just a matter of time.
You said something about going up and down. Well, it just so happens that many people think that the science budgets and support and resources going up and down is the very thing that strangles scientific research. Do you agree?
In terms of science, I think it's the Mandy Rice Davis School of Philosophy. Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? Of course I would say that, wouldn't I? But it does seem to be true to me that you've got to have that continuity. However, although we have been blessed with that sort of continuity in the UK for some time, if you look at the proportion of GDP that we spend on science compared with other countries like Germany and France, it is considerably lower. You're going to ask me the exact number, and I'm going to be embarrassed to not remember exactly what it is, but it's a good sort of percent or so less.
I know what it is in Australia. It's 2.2, roughly. And in Israel, it's twice as much, 4.2.
Of course, it depends on how you do your sums. I'm not sure we're at 2.2 in the UK. We're around that kind of number. Of course, I'd like to see it as high as it is in Israel. And I think we could do a good job how we spend that and come up with great ways and reasons why. But we have to make those reasons. You know, you have to accept that you are in competition with other infrastructure type activities. And so scientists need to engage with government. They need to be able to make those points, and they need access to government in order to be able to make those arguments. And actually, I think government, by and large, is happy to have scientists make those arguments. And I don't care if I'm called a geek, frankly. It could be anything I like, as long as we get more science going.
Softly spoken evil.
Now,
the final question, if you ask them in Israel why they spend so much on scientific research, they say innovation.
Yeah.
You can fail with innovation, but if there's enough backing, you then bounce back again and you have a success next time.
Yes.
But essentially what you do is create wealth for the nation, and well over half of such wealth comes from scientific research.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually had the British Council had a short conference for 2 days earlier this week in Canberra, part of the Global Education Dialogue, and it was capturing the innovation dividend, essentially. And it was great. There was a very full and frank discussion. And absolutely, the issue of innovation, and Australia and the UK are similar. We're not very good at failing. The Americans and the Israelis are great at, I failed twice, so now you've really got to trust me that I know what it is that I'm trying to avoid. They are great at failing and coming back and having another go, and we get embarrassed when we fail. And I think we need to do something about that culture. I really do.
How do you change it, do you think?
I think you start at universities, you have parts of the courses associated with innovation structures, you have the kind of project work, you challenge the students, you get the students together from different departments and you make them do these exciting projects. They love doing this sort of stuff. And you encourage them to have more than one go at it. What did you learn from the last one? What did you do wrong? What was that human factors issues that you didn't take into account because you're scientists and engineers, and actually you need to think about the social science as well? And how is that going to help you to move forward?
Not a bad gig for a scientist. Robin Grimes is an ambassador for science with the UK Foreign Office and a professor of materials physics at Imperial College London and at the University of New South Wales.